Missions history has no end of great examples of excellence for us. And as we look at the greatest century of missions, one of the greatest missionaries of all time was Hudson Taylor, the apostle to China. Now, Hudson Taylor's father, James Taylor, was a chemist. And before Hudson Taylor was even born, James Taylor knelt beside his 24-year-old wife, Amelia, in their parlor at the back of their busy chemist shop in Yorkshire, England, and they prayed, "Dear God, if you should give us a son, grant that he may work for you in China." By age four, Hudson would declare, "When I am a man, I mean to be a missionary and to go to China." Hudson was home educated and he grew up in a godly home. However, by age 17, he was severely backslidden. He is restless and rebellious against his parents. In June 1849, when he was 17, his mother locked herself in the room 50 miles from where Hudson Taylor was and determined to pray that her son would become a Christian and that she would not leave the room until she was sure that her prayers had been answered. That same afternoon, Hudson Taylor picked up a gospel tract and he was struck by the phrase, "the finished work of Christ." And he wrote that light was flashed into my soul by the Holy Spirit. There was nothing to be done but to fall down on my knees and to pray for salvation. As he rushed breathlessly home to tell his mother how he had been born again, she interrupted him and told him she already knew. Hudson wrote of the intense longing for God that gripped him. "From that time, the conviction never left me that I was called to China." Immediately he began to prepare himself by studying Chinese through a copy of Luke's Gospel in Mandarin. He denied himself comforts and he imposed disciplines on himself to prepare himself for the mission field. He undertook work amongst the poor and the sick and he read avidly on China. He also threw himself into studying Latin and Greek and theology and medicine. Hudson immersed himself in the Bible and in prayer, including an entire night of intense prayer. One word came to characterize Hudson Taylor, and that was faith. He determined to trust God alone for all his needs. He loved to give to God, and so tithing was soon left far behind as he gave away two-thirds of his income. His maxim became, "See if you can do without." His concern for China grew into an overwhelming burden, and he felt as though Christ's compassion for the multitudes in China was flooding his soul. Meeting a missionary to China, Hudson Taylor excitedly told him of his plans, and the missionary discouraged him, telling him the Chinese would never receive him on account of his fair hair. Later, while trying to dye his hair black, Hudson was injured and almost blinded when ammonia mixture exploded the glass bottle that it was mixed in. It's long before they had plastic bottles. To think he could have ended his missionary calling before it even started. In 1853, as the Taiping Rebellion broke out, Hudson Taylor was just 21 years old. He said goodbye, an emotional goodbye to his mother, and he sailed from England. He's going to a war zone, and he had to travel 17,000 miles, over 29,000 kilometers, by sea, from Liverpool to Shanghai, around the Cape of Good Hope. The journey by sea took 6 months, and it included a severe storm. By the time Hudson Taylor landed in Shanghai in 1854, the Taiping rebels, held the city, and 50,000 imperial soldiers besieged it. Now, to put this in historical context, General Charles Gordon made his name fighting the Taiping rebels and fought 13 battles in as many months, winning against the Taiping rebels and put it down, and that's where he got his nicknamed Chinese Gordon from. Horrific sights and sounds greeted Hudson Taylor. China was passing through an immense upheaval. There were severe major uprisings in China in the 1850s and 1860s, and two of them resulted in 25 million dead from these wars. Another 10 million died in the years between 1877 and 1879 in a famine in the north of the country. So you can just imagine the incredible situation where tens of millions are dying in this country, China. There were also wars between China and Britain, between China and France, between China and Russia, between China and Japan. this hardly seemed to be the time to launch a new mission to China. But Hudson Taylor was gripped by the fact that some 380 million people in the vast interior of China had never seen a Westerner nor heard the name of Christ, and he was determined to change that. The house Hudson Taylor was staying in Shanghai was struck by gunfire. The house next to his was destroyed. Nevertheless, he gave himself to the study of the language, to evangelism, and to helping the victims of the war. During these fearsome upheavals, Hudson traveled to take the gospel to previously unevangelized areas. One of these trips was a 200-mile journey up the Yangtze River, and he frequently witnessed people being beheaded, and he himself came very close to being lynched on occasion. It was during this time that he developed a brief but deep friendship with William Chambers Burns, an outstanding missionary to China. And they determined together to adopt the Chinese dress. Burns and Taylor were men of one heart and one mind. They stayed at Swatow, a center of the opium trade and the most wicked place imaginable. Burns was taken prisoner during their time in Swatow. Hudson Taylor's decision to shave his head and adopt Chinese dress was rooted in his deep respect for the Chinese culture and his view of the role of the missionary. The missionary must incarnate himself in a society just as Christ became man, and his incarnation, he came to the world, he spoke our language, he walked amongst us, and so as a missionary we must not present the gospel as something foreign, but as something that is indigenous. Many Chinese objected to Christianity, argued, because it seemed to be a foreign religion. He said they're not necessarily rejecting Christianity, they're rejecting a foreign religion. We need to make it a Chinese faith. Now, his decision was greeted with derision and with contempt by most of the Westerners. And for his part, Taylor thought many of the missionaries to China were worldly, lacking in dedication, and ineffective. Hudson Taylor's proposals for marriage had already been rejected by two women in England, then met and courted a missionary teacher, Maria Dyer, the much sought-after 20-year-old daughter of prestigious missionary parents. The missionary establishment was horrified at this unsophisticated missionary who had gone native wearing Chinese dress, and they opposed the marriage. However, Maria showed herself to be of equal dedication to Hudson, and on the 20th of January 1858, Hudson Taylor and Maria Dyer became husband and wife, and it was to be an uncommonly happy marriage, largely because they shared the same deep passion to evangelize China at great personal sacrifice. That's similar visions. From the start, they were frequently in danger, and their first child, Grace, was born with a riot raging outside their home. Hudson's missionary partner, Dr. Parker, who had opened a clinic at Ningpo, was compelled to return to Scotland when his wife died. Here you can see marked with an X the window at the back of the Taylor's residence, where they had a rope prepared to throw out the window, because on this bridge road, if they were attacked, there was only one way of escape, which was out this back window, where they and their baby would have to flee if they were attacked, which of course was common, that they would be attacked. Everyone was being attacked, not just Europeans. It was a very violent time in China's history. With supplies dwindling and Hudson's health deteriorating, he had to make the painful decision to close the medical clinic and return to England. There he was to remain for 6 long years. But this temporary retreat proved to be the precursor to a great missionary advance. His burden for inland China was becoming overwhelming, and the only relief he could find was in prayer and in the Word of God. First, earnest prayer to God to thrust forth laborers, and second, the deepening of the spiritual life of the church so that men should be unable to stay at home, he said. In 1865, Hudson dictated a book to his wife, China, Its Spiritual Need and Claims. And he paced restlessly on the floor while Maria took down the dictation. One paragraph declared, "Can all the Christians of England sit still with folded arms while these multitudes in China are perishing, perishing for lack of knowledge? The lack of that knowledge which England possesses so richly, which has made England what England is and has made us what we are. What does the Master teach us? Is it not that one sheep out of 100 be lost, we are to leave the 99 and seek out that one But here the proportions are almost reversed. And we stay at home with the one sheep, and we take no heed to the 99 sheep that are perishing. Hudson knew that a new missionary organization dedicated to the evangelization of inland China was needed. At that stage, the missionaries were only going to the coastal cities, which is where there was protection and contact with the West. It's understandable. But inland China was the unreached challenge. And at this point, he found himself racked with doubt. He really slept for 2 hours at a time. He agonized over the desperate spiritual plight of China and with what he called his unbelief. Strange that a man who's epitomized faith, that he grappled with unbelief. He feared taking responsibility for sending young men and women into the interior of China, where they would be subjected to danger, to rejection, to illness, and to severe persecution. He thought that he was on the verge of a nervous breakdown. He wrote, "For 2 or 3 months, intense conflict, I thought I should lose my mind." One Sunday morning, he slipped out of a church in England after worship, unable to bear the sight of a congregation of 1,000 or more Christian people, rejoicing in their own security, while millions are perishing for lack of knowledge. He wrote that he wandered on the sands of Brighton Beach alone and in great spiritual agony. "But during this prayer walk, the Lord conquered my unbelief," he wrote, "and I surrendered myself to God for the service. I told him that all the responsibility must rest with him, that as a servant it was mine to obey and to follow him. It was his to direct, to care for, and to guide me, and to guide those who might labor with me." Immediately he wrote in the margin of his Bible, "Prayed for 24 willing, skillful laborers, Brighton, June 25, 1865. The China Inland Mission that Hudson now planned to launch was innovative and radical for the time. Hudson Taylor launched the first truly interdenominational faith mission. Up till then, all missions were denominational. Baptist missions, such as launched by William Carey, Church of England missions, Presbyterian missions, London Missionary Society. But now we've got the first truly interdenominational faith mission. And it was innovative in many other ways. There were to be all kinds of distinctives. From the first, Hudson Taylor determined that China in mission would have 6 distinctive features. Number one, its missionaries would be drawn from any denomination, provided they could sign its evangelical Protestant doctrinal statement. That's the first innovation. Secondly, CIA missionaries would receive no salaries, but trust the Lord to supply their needs. Income would be shared, no debts would be incurred. Thirdly, no appeals for funds would be made. The first faith mission. Fourth, the work abroad would not be directed by the home committee, but by himself and eventually other leaders in the field in China. Up till then, all missions had been run from the home base, wherever that may be, and not from the field. And he said, no, it's being operated in the field. You can't wait 6 months for reply. Well, China would be a year. It takes 6 months by boat to go one way. Number five, the organization would press on into the interior of China where Christ has not yet been named. After the China Inland Mission came the Africa Inland Mission and many other groups like that. The missionaries would wear Chinese clothing. They would worship in Chinese-style buildings. In addition, CIM would use lay workers rather than ordained ministers. Up to then, to be a missionary, you had to be a minister of the gospel. But for the first time, he was open to lay people joining the mission. And even single women. Now, married women could be involved in missions before this, but this is the first time single women were welcomed into missions. So all of this for that time was radical. Hudson Taylor was a trendsetter. He was setting the pace and he was breaking into territory that no one had ever gone down before. Within the year, Hudson and Maria Taylor and their 4 children set sail for China with 16 young missionaries on board. Soon there were 24 CIM missionaries in China. God's blessing on this new enterprise was soon evident, with 20 of the ship's crew making commitments to Christ during the long voyage out to China. But within the year, the new mission was engulfed in opposition, dissension, controversy, fire, and death. In 1867, the Taylor's daughter, their oldest daughter, Grace, died. Their mission house in Yang Chau was attacked and set on fire. Furious persecution engulfed them. As Hudson Taylor wrote, "If the Spirit of God works mightily, we may be sure that the spirit of evil will also be active." Undeterred, Hudson treated more than 200 patients each day, with one of his converts, too, preaching to the patients who were waiting for medical treatment. Hudson made enormous demands on himself and he expected equally high standards from other CIM missionaries. One of his new missionaries, Louis Nickel, third from the left in the front row over here, Louis Nickel grew increasingly bitter and resentful of Taylor's leadership style, and he spent his time visiting other missionaries and grumbling and sowing dissension. Louis Nickel soon abandoned Chinese dress, claiming that the English clothes gave him greater protection and respect. "I will not be bound neck and heel to any man," he declared. After nearly 2 years of unpleasantness and disruption, Hudson regretfully dismissed Nickel from the mission, mainly for unrelenting slander and lies. And three CIM missionaries resigned in sympathy with Nickel. He had done an Absalom on him. At around the same time, two other CIM missionaries complained that it was dangerous for so many unmarried women and men to be living together at New Lane, the CIM headquarters in China. They accused Hudson Taylor of being too familiar with the young ladies because Hudson and Maria kissed some of the girls on the forehead before they went off to bed. The ladies themselves denied that there was anything inappropriate about this behavior, but still the complaint reached London, and for a time it led to a fall in support for the mission. In spite of constant controversies, the number of CIM missionaries grew, and in time, China Inland Mission became the largest mission organization in the world. Then Timothy Richard, a Welsh Baptist, began to cause further divisions within the mission, arguing that God also works through other religions like Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism. A handful of missionaries were also influenced by Richard's liberal views and they left the mission. As Hudson began sending unmarried single women into the interior, another storm of controversy and criticism erupted. The courage of these tenacious young pioneers cannot be exaggerated. Annie Roll Taylor, no relation to Hudson Taylor, was one of the many bold individualists who joined CIM. She set her sights on taking the gospel to the forbidden city of Lhasa in the heart of Tibet, high up in the Himalayas. She adopted native Tibetan dress. She shaved her head in the fashion of a Tibetan nun. Bandits stole her tent and clothing, killed most of her pack horses. Some of her workmen died and others turned back. But she didn't give up. One of her Chinese workers demanded more money, and when that was refused, he brought false accusations against her to the Tibetan authorities, which led to her arrest. It was going from bad to worse. But Annie Taylor finally established her own agency, the Tibetan Pioneer Mission, recruiting 14 missionaries to work with her in this highest mission field in the world. But in less than a year, all had left her, and this infant mission was in a shambles. However, Annie Taylor continued. She persevered for more than 20 years working mostly alone in Tibet, certainly the highest mission field on earth. Hudson Taylor did not make any distinction between married women and single women. He expected married women to focus primarily on ministry, even as the single sisters did. To male recruits, he wrote, "Unless you intend your wife to be a true missionary and not merely a wife, homemaker and friend, do not join us." Maria set the pace for the other married women in the mission, caring for 5 children and actively reaching out to the Chinese women in daily outreach. In 1870, the Taylor's son Samuel died, and then their 5th son, Noel, died 2 weeks after being born. Then a few days later, Maria Taylor died at age 33. 4 of Maria's 8 children died before they could reach age 10. 4 out of 8. That's not unusual. The American missionary, first foreign missionary from the United States who went to Burma, Adoniram Judson, out of his 10 children, 5 died before reaching adulthood. Medical science was not as advanced then. The mission field was even more unhygienic and dangerous than it is today. Hudson returned to England, married Jenny Faulding, and suffered an accident which left him with a damaged spine. But even while recovering and immobile, he refused to be idle. Prayer and planning filled his time. China is not to be won for Christ by quiet, ease-loving men and women. The stamp of men and women we need is such as will put Jesus, China, and souls first and foremost in everything and at every time. Even life itself must be secondary to Jesus, China, and souls. As someone who had literally given up everything to Christ in China, he found it impossible to expect lesser commitment from others. Hudson was frequently accused of being demanding and autocratic, but in his mind he is merely anxious to protect the integrity of the mission. In spite of constant poor health and regular bouts with depression, and his own self-confessed irritation and impatience, he could also show tremendous flexibility and steadfastness under trial. Hudson and Jenny Taylor presented an incredible example of dedication. And when they were bequeathed several thousand pounds, they gave it all to the mission. They were frequently separate from one another and engaged in demanding journeys and a relentless schedule of ministry. Still, Hudson Taylor could declare at the end of his life that the sun had never risen upon him in China without finding him at prayer. There was an urgency in everything that he did. He was a man of faith who stated that his life was based upon three facts. There is a living God. He has spoken in the Bible. He means what he says and he will do all that he has promised. That's a good three-point foundation for any life. In a letter to his mother, Hudson described his own assessment of his life in these words. Envied by some, despised by many, hated perhaps by others, blamed for things I never heard of or had anything to do with, an innovator on what have become established rules of missionary practice, an opponent of mighty systems of heathen error and superstitions, working without precedent in many respects and with few experienced helpers, often sick in body as well as perplexed in mind and embarrassed by circumstances. Had not the Lord been specifically gracious to me, had not my mind been sustained by the conviction that the work is his, and that he is with me in the thick of the conflict, I must have fainted and broken down. But the battle is the Lord's, and he will conquer. We may fail, we do fail continually, but he never fails. Indeed, by the end of Hudson's life, the very mission organizations that had belittled and ridiculed his methods had begun adopting many of them. Plagiarism is the best form of flattery. By the time Hudson Taylor died, there were 205 China inland mission stations. Here they are marked on the map. 205 mission stations, 849 missionaries, 125,000 Chinese gathered in their congregations. That's the fruit of the first interdenominational faith mission. The Great Commission is not an option to be considered, it is a command to be obeyed. That's one of the great quotes of Hudson Taylor. The Great Commission is a command to be obeyed. God's man in God's place, doing God's will to God's glory, will never lack for God's support. Another Hudson Taylor quote. Now we've got a chapter on Hudson Taylor in the Greatest Century of Missions. The China Inland Mission has since changed its name to Overseas Missionary Fellowship and expanded its work much wider. There are books available on China's Millions and the Growth of the Work of God, written by Dr. and Mrs. Howard Taylor, Howard Taylor being a grandson of Hudson Taylor. And there's other great books, Hudson Taylor, Missionary Pioneer of Inland China, Gospel Pioneer to China, and The Growth of a Soul. There's all kinds of books aimed for young people as well, in different languages even. We've got some of these books at Christian Liberty Books. Christian Heroes Then Now, Deep in the Heart of China, God's Adventurer, A Story of Daring, Danger, and Dependence on God, Friend of China, The Shaping of Modern China with Hudson Taylor's Influence. What would history be like without that? At the time that the communists took over China, there were something in the region of 1 million Protestant Christians in China. Today it's estimated that it could be over 105 million today. So after the most relentless communist attempt to destroy the church has increased 10,000%. Hudson and Maria Taylor, A Match Made in Heaven, is another of these books. Intimacy with Jesus is a book written by Hudson Taylor. Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secrets, foreword by George Verver. This is a classic printed by Moody. Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secrets has been republished in many different forms. Hudson Taylor in the early years. This remains a great mission field, the largest nation on earth. We need to pray through Operation World for China. There is so much on China. There's more on China than any other country in the world in Operation World, because it's the most complex, there's the most people. There's so many different people groups, and each region has their own distinctives. This is the steps that we can take to claiming every nation for Christ. And there's also a film, which we've got for tonight, which has been put together very well. And this is a Ken Anderson film on Hudson Taylor, which we'll be showing tonight. Are there any questions at all on Hudson Taylor? Without a doubt. Oh, nobody laid more solid foundations and made a greater impact in China than Hudson Taylor. It would be impossible to consider there being such a strong house church movement in China today without the sacrifice of China Inland Mission. And what we haven't touched here is the vast amount of China Inland missionaries who died in the Boxer Rebellion in 1900. It was hideous. Vast amounts of martyrs. The Boxer Rebellion of 1900 was a great backlash of the Confucian religion and the nationalist Chinese trying to crush the Christian interest. And they targeted especially the Protestant Christians, and many, many, many Chinese missionaries were murdered, martyred during that time. So Hudson Taylor's missionaries paid a tremendous sacrifice. And all the way through to the Second World War, the Japanese murdered many more, and there was even more killed under the communists, of course. And then finally the communists kicked them all out in 1949. And that's when China Inland Mission relocated to Nationalist China, Republic of China, and what today is called Taiwan. And they renamed themselves Overseas Missionary Fellowship and focused on the expatriate Chinese, the Chinese refugees who had fled from mainland China. And then radio ministry back in, and now they're back. Although they've got to work very surreptitiously inside China, because it's still run by the communists, of course. But there's no mission that has done a fraction of what China and the mission did in laying the foundations. If China gets converted to Christ, it'll be thanks to the work that was done in the 19th century by Hudson Taylor and his co-workers. And many people are looking to that. They're looking to the possibility that China may become a Christian nation, which of course inevitably the day will come when every knee will bow and every nation will worship Christ and all the kings of the earth will worship him. So that will come.
They say that in about 3 years time it will be the biggest English speaking nation in the world, China.
Well, while English is the most spoken language in the world and the main language of the internet, printing and so on, Chinese is the largest language, where it's the first language and the home language. It should also be interesting that the communists, in trying to destroy the church, actually helped it in some way, because what they did was they forced everyone in the country to become literate, and they took the 20,000, 26,000 characters of Chinese, simplified down to 2,000 characters. You know, we don't appreciate this because we've got only 26 letters in the alphabet, and so it's very simple for us. But the Chinese, they've got to memorize these thousands of characters. Well, the communists simplified the language, which actually made the job of proclaiming the gospel easier. They also unified the language, whereas before it was much more diverse in different areas. So just like the Romans, in their hostility to the gospel, actually built the roads and the postal service and the system that later carried the gospel, so the communist Chinese have unwittingly served the cause of the gospel. One of the things the communists have done which actually serves the cause of the gospel in a backward, roundabout way, is until 1949, Christianity was perceived as a foreign religion in China, and Confucianism predominant. The communists crushed and destroyed the Confucian ancient religion, and they kicked all the missionaries out, which everyone thought was catastrophic. But the missionaries had done such a good job that the church thrived even on its own, on the basis of the work that had been done. So that today, the Christians in China are perceived as thoroughly indigenous. Nobody can say they're a foreign religion. There's been no foreign missionaries inside China running the show there for decades, generations. So now, Christianity in China is totally indigenous. Communism is the foreign ideology. Christianity is seeped in indigenous. The old opposition to Christianity has disappeared. Now there's a hostility to the communism, which is oppressing people. So in a roundabout way, we can say thank you to the Communist Party in trying to destroy the church. They've actually helped the church thrive more than ever. I don't know that we could have ever seen growth to over 100 million Christians in China without the persecution of the church by the communists. They have been the own worst enemies, and they've been a very unlikely friend for the church. Now, that's not my assessment. That's what I've heard from missionaries to China. That's their estimation. I've actually met the great-grandson of Hudson Taylor, who back in the 80s was the General Secretary of the Overseas Missionary Fellowship. How wonderful that they still got that line, the great-grandchild. And he's Hudson Taylor III, I think. And that was his estimation, that today, thanks to the communists, Christianity is runaway, unstoppable, the biggest force in China. If you think how few Chinese are Communist Party members, there's vastly more Christians in China than Communist Party members. Now, of course, they've got the political power, but their days are numbered.
You know that the South African Bibles are being printed in China. The Bible Society has all of its Bibles printed in China on very nice paper, very good quality. But this surely will also have quite an impact there in China.
China's determined to build up their economy by doing everything cheaper than you can get anywhere else.
Mm.
Now, we've had many, many Bibles printed in South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and we found it cheaper than anywhere else. I've heard of some people going for printing in China. We've never been willing to consider that. But
well,
there's no doubt Asia, you can get some much better printing options.
Mm.
I would not want to give business to China because I think slaves could be doing the work. I think that's a mistake of the Bible Society to get things printed there. But on the other hand, if the people know English, it's got to be quite difficult for them to keep this totally under wraps. The gospel is getting into China. They are.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot stop it. They're trying. But there's no way that they can stop it anymore. Any other comments, observations? No, but I've heard him. He came to Stellenbosch some time ago, and I went there, met him, and heard his presentation. I actually don't have a book though.
What do you think of
it? It sounded interesting. I think the house church movement in China is dynamic, but I don't know that they've got much to teach us in terms of doctrine. I think they need help with that. But devotion, they can teach us a lot in devotion. They're very devout, very pious, very dedicated to prayer, but because the society is not an open society, because they don't have freedom of speech, they are struggling, I think, on the doctrinal side. I fear that some of their teachings are poor doctrine, poor understanding of scriptures. They don't have the iron sharpening iron. Many of their ministers have no proper theological training, of course. I see that as a problem. China needs Bible teaching. I thought somewhat the Heavenly Man representative set was. Poor theology, but for enthusiasm and zeal, they get top marks. These people are great examples in devotion. My concern is that the people in the West who want to look to some of these folks not as examples in devotion, but in examples of doctrine. I think that's foolish. You don't get your doctrinal standards from people who've gone through some of the worst of persecution because they haven't been studying the issues and they haven't been subjected to decent biblical or theological training. They might be willing to die for Christ. Their hearts might be right, but that doesn't mean their mind's right. They're still products of a brainwashed system of secular humanist education. I find that very dangerous.